Blog Talk Radio.
California, it's Thursday, February 14th, 2013, and it's Valentine's Day. And this is the Hermetic Hour with your lovable host, Paul Crunyon. And tonight, we'll interview the distinguished scholar and author, Jeffrey James, whose historical novel, Sorcerer, on Elizabethan Marcus John Dee, has just been released. And it's on Amazon, and you can one-click it. It should be noted that Jeffrey James is also the author of Enochian Evocation of Dr. John Dee and Angel Magic, both of which are factual and practical works on the magical art. Now, Jeffrey brings a unique combination of talents to this new novel. He is an historian, a magician, and a masterful storyteller. Now, there have been other novels based on the magical adventures or misadventures of Dr. Dee and Edward Kelly, and some have been written by magicians themselves, but Sorcerer is far and away the best yet. The characters are real, the setting is alive, the story is gripping, and the tragedy is classic. Now, if Jeffrey had opted for a more reflective, less contemporary style, he could have expanded the book to 500 pages without even breaking a sweat, but he would have produced a piece of literature, but how well would that have sold in today's market? What he did was equally artistic. He produced a modern version, fast-paced, emotionally charged, bestseller and thriller style, and he still managed to keep the mood, the tone, and the depth of a classic. I would give it 6 stars if I could. So, as we said, tune in and meet the best author of magical fiction since Dion Fortune. And Jeffrey, by the way, tells me he likes Jack Vance. And we covered Jack Vance and Clark Ashton Smith a week or so ago. And I suggested that perhaps Edward Kelly was Vance's model for his roguish hero Cujo, and then Jeff proceeded to say, no, wait a minute, Cujo was my model for the way I did Edward Kelly. So I think Jeff's hanging on the line right now, but I do want to say this, that I know Jeff for years, and he is, he was a Rhodes Scholar. He's just an all-around Renaissance man and a wonderful magician. And nobody else really had the background that he has to write this book. And he did a marvelous, marvelous job. Jeff, I got you on the line?
Jeff, I think so.
Oh, you think you're on. Well, it sounds like
yeah.
You are.
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to... Now, first, let's qualify this. The title is just Sorcerer, right?
The full title is Sorcerer, a novel of Queen Elizabeth's Alchemist.
Oh, well, but there's no the. It's just Sorcerer.
You know, for a while it was the Sorcerer, but no, the actual title is Sorcerer, a novel of Queen Elizabeth's Alchemist.
Yeah, you know, you sent me this advanced copy back last year. And I had got it right before we went to Atlanta to do a seasonal and help and initiate a bunch of people. And I read it on the plane, and I read it, and I was still reading it in Atlanta while we were doing all that. I couldn't put it down. It's just absolutely it's a terrific read, and it also the thing that I was just really really found remarkable was your grasp of the novelist, or at least the contemporary novelist's art. Have you ever read a book by Dean Kuntz called How to Write Best-Selling Fiction?
No, I haven't. In fact, I don't read all that much fiction myself, oddly enough, or read about writing fiction. The way I learned to write like that was by... this is strange. You probably didn't even know this. The way I learned to write like that was by making a movie using computer games. And that's how it taught me how to think in a cinematic way. And the characteristic of literature today is that it thinks, you have to kind of think in terms of how scenes are blocked and what people are seeing at a particular time. And so I kept that in mind, kind of this is what the point of view would be like. And so I think that added to the effect that I tried to get in the novel.
Well, it seemed to me, quite frankly, and this is, I mean this strictly as a compliment, Dean Kuntz wrote this book, How to Sell Best-Selling Fiction, or How to Write Best-Selling Fiction, because all of his science fiction buddies were jumping on him for writing mainstream stuff. So he wrote the book just to tell them how to do it. Basically, he didn't necessarily want to write it. But it became a Bible, and sort of an insider's Bible, and Dan Brown just studied Dean Kuntz's book to the point where you could just see how Dan Brown's novels were progressing along the Dean Kuntz formula. And what you've got here is a Dean Kuntz. It looks like you were just cut your teeth on Dean Kuntz, because you've just really you produced a modern mainstream. In other words, mainstream readers can read this and enjoy it. I mean, really enjoy it.
I think that's true. It was. What the real challenge was in this book was to introduce the concepts of ritual magic as people would have seen it in the Renaissance without getting outside the characters and trying to, you know, like turn it into a fantasy novel. What I did was, in each scene, it's blocked up, and each passage is told from the viewpoint of a particular character. It never breaks point of view. So when Edward Kelly is having a vision, this is what he is seeing at this point, and then it'll move over to what Dee is seeing and how he's perceiving what's going on with Edward Kelly, and in that way I was able to kind of make it experiential, for this is what it would have been like to be there with either in Edward Kelly's head while all this stuff was happening, or John Dee, or their wives, or the people surrounding them.
Well, that's another thing, by the way, that people should, reading this, will probably just slide right through it without appreciating how difficult multiple viewpoint is to handle. And you have handled it very, very, very well. And I've done multiple viewpoint novels, and I've also done single viewpoint. Single viewpoint is much, much easier. It really is. Multiple viewpoint is a challenge, and you really met the challenge to the point where you don't even, as you're reading it, you don't even realize it's smooth.
No one who's read it has actually commented on the fact that it never, not once does it break point of view. It's always told from the viewpoint of one character, and some of the scenes are quite complicated because we're dealing with a complicated phenomenon. As you know, and I'm going to address this a little bit later, because I learned a lot about what that magic was like from talking to you and from the long conversations we had back in the late 70s and early 80s. But as you know, it's a complex psychological phenomenon, magic is. It's not simple. It's something that changes the way people think while they're doing it. And it's extremely experiential. So what I tried to get into the heads of the characters so I could see what would it really be like to be there.
Well, you're right.
To be happening to you.
And you have made it exciting and suspenseful without succumbing to producing a Hollywood type of thing where the magic is is totally physical and not subjective. In other words, Hollywood insists, and I do this for dramatic purposes, and I know that because I've written some of this stuff myself. They insist on making magic appear to be actually physically happening in the sense that everybody, including the camera, sees it. Well, that's not the way it is, and we know that. And you've handled this in a mature, actually authentic, mature way, and yet you still have managed to keep the intensity and the excitement and the mystery of it without succumbing to this Hollywood formula.
Yeah,
and I really appreciate that.
Well, you know, I in a way I wrote it for people like you and your audience and the people who are involved in thinking about things like this. Because I really wanted to capture some of the sense of what actually goes on, as opposed to, as you say, a Hollywood depiction of it. But basically, if you can create a fantasy world where magic works in a physical way, like it's just another form of science. In fact, if you look at the Harry Potter books, all magic is an alternative form of science. It's just cooler and more fun and more, you know, more romantic looking than science. But what I've tried to do here says, what did it look like in the real world to John Dee? What did it look like to Edward Kelly? What did it look like to the people around, given the way that they thought about the world and the way that they perceived things? And so, what I tried to do, and like I said, the only reason I was able to do that is because I was, you know, I got interested in John Dee back in the late 70s, and it was all theoretical to me. But then I started, I ended up connecting with you, I think through mail, I think, or I might have called you or something because I heard about you, and we ended up talking about it and I kind of learned from you, well, this is what it must have actually been like. So, you know, I've been carrying that thought with me now for about, you know, I had been carrying it for about 20 years, and so when I decided the book, I'm just going to say, I'll take that knowledge and put it into this book.
Yes, well, you not only that, I want to out you a little bit here because you not only did talk to me about it, but you did it also. You did it with me, so you know what you're talking about.
That does help. And especially, for instance, I noticed I was going through, flipping through the book again. I read it, as I say, right straight on through, and I was just absolutely gripped by it. But I was flipping through here again, just kind of picking up stuff. And you have one of my favorites back in here. Let's see if I can find it. I turned it down. Here it goes. Dee stopped reading so that he might examine this phenomenon more clearly, but the strange light seemed then to vanish. And so he read on. Arise, move, therefore, and appear. Open up the mysteries of your creation and make us partakers of the undefiled knowledge.
Gotta love that Enochian.
Well, that's what we use.
That phrase is what we use constantly over and over again after we end the call of the 30 Aethers. And, of course, translating that into Enochian, it goes, Sakar with Samran Odo Kikleka Sorge Lamsirdo Nokoman Hoathia Ida. I love that.
Oh, that's
I'm glad you stuck that in
beat,
there.
Can't beat Enoch, yeah. One of the things that I've been playing with, actually, I posted on the website for the book is sorcerer.net. And I posted some discussions that I've been having on the origins, likely origins of Enochian and whether it's actually a language or not. I've always maintained that it's probably a fully formed, created language with characteristics of Latin, German, and Hebrew.
Yeah.
And then I found out that there actually are some words. It may actually be a degraded form of Hebrew that just floated through.
Well,
but there's so many mysteries connected with where the Enochian language came from, and I tried to capture
the
controversy in the book.
Well,
Well, I'm going to get technical now. I did have to make my way through structural linguistics in order to, you know, get my shingle. So I want to ask you this question now, because I know you're deeper into this, and your laugh is a hell of a lot better than mine. What I want to ask is this. You know from that Latin Picatrix, that Latin Picatrix that we have in the British Museum, the one I know you and I have both looked at it. In fact, I think I gave you my manuscript copy of it at one time. But it is in, that's Latin, but it's in English grammar. It's not Kikaronian, and it's not church, it wouldn't be like German church Latin. It's actually in English grammar, and it has English punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
So these people that just throw off on Enochian and they say, oh, well, it has an English grammar. Well, yeah, but so does English Latin. Now, what do you think about
it? It is true that it has some things that are in it, but it has some other things in it that are very extremely awkward in English and concepts
mm-hmm.
that are encapsulated in words that don't work well in English. So it depends on what part of you... It you look at. It does. So, the great proponent of that it's just someone made up in English and that it's a cipher code of English word for word is Donald Laycock. And we can bat this around back and forth forever, but I think there's pretty good evidence that if Edward Kelly created the language, he created it, or whoever created it, if it's a creative language, created it with characteristics of multiple languages, not just
English. Yeah. Well, Kelly had no Greek, and he had no Latin. And
he had Latin. He understood
Latin.
Oh, he did
have Latin.
But kind of schoolboy. Schoolboy Latin.
Oh, school, yeah. Well, but somebody pointed out, and I've said this several times, that because he did not have a sufficient, they didn't have a command of ancient Greek or Hebrew, that, and of course also I thought Latin too, that when he started to channel this, that he used Noam Chomsky's grammar machine that we're all born with, supposedly, according to Chomsky. He used that grammar machine to produce his own language. And there have been some things about studies about children, you know, if they don't learn a language, they'll create one of their own, you know. And this support, I don't know, what do you think about that?
I think it's unlikely. I think it's far more likely that it falls into the category of a specifically created language. The reason why it probably isn't that is because of the way it was dictated, which was about the first third was dictated backwards.
Yeah.
The rest was dictated forwards, and it was tapped out letter by letter. And the only way that you could, so it didn't come out as an actual language. And I know of no examples of an adult who already speaks a language spontaneously creating a language. So I think that's a fairly absurd notion that's where it came from.
Yeah, well, that's
it seems unlikely.
In other words, what you're saying is that he's getting a transmission from somewhere, or either that, or he's had access at some point, either in this life or a past life or something, or other, he's had access to this.
Yeah, I think there's a number of possibilities.
Yeah,
and you kind of walk through it. You can kind of look at what's most likely. Let me tell you what I think is most likely. What is most likely, I believe, is that Edward Kelly himself stumbled upon a manuscript from probably at the University of Krakow, which was the second oldest university in Europe. Came across this and figured out what it was. And kind of adapted and memorized it. That I think is a good possibility. The other possibility is that he was just a linguistic genius and figured out how to create a language and created this interesting language on his own, much like J.R.R. Tolkien created his Elvish language and his dwarf language and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, actually, he would have had to, in order to deliver it backwards the way he did, he would actually have to have prepared or really known what he was. He'd have to be like Manly Hall. In other words, he'd have to be able to look at it almost like a photographic memory. Remember, Manly Hall used to sit there and you could tell he was reading his lecture like he was reading it on a teleprompter.
Well, you know,
I don't know whether he ever saw one of those lectures of his, but that's what he'd do. He'd look up, and he'd read it like he was reading it on a teleprompter. And this would go on for an hour and a half, and then he'd say, "Well, that's all for today, folks." You know, that'd be that. And Mary Kamer, you know, our Mary Kamer, he has an audiographic memory. All he has to do is read it aloud, and it can be a couple hours long, and he's got it.
Well, you know, in the Middle Ages, it was not unusual for a scholar to be able to quote entire books verbatim. In fact, there was a kind of exercise that scholars were instructed to do called the art of memory, where they would build like a house in their mind and put everything in little slots and stuff like that. And basically, they'd build the memory in their mind so that they could quote long passages, and they often would in their works just from memory. And it's certainly a possibility that Edward Kelly might have stumbled upon that technique at some point, or maybe just use a crib sheet.
And yet we tend to think of Kelly, and you kind of picture him this way. You know, we were joking at the beginning that maybe Vance based Kugel on Kelly, and then you said, "No, wait a minute, I used Kugel for my characterization of Kelly." But Kelly, the way you picture him and the way we usually think of him as kind of a very, very gifted psychic, but also kind of unscrupulous and not very moral and rather low class, but with a tremendous psychic gift. That's the way he's usually pictured. And I think that's pretty much the way you have him pictured here.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be the first person in the world that falls into that characterization.
Yeah. Well, that's supposedly he had his ears lopped off for fraud. Well, let's get, you know, we're splitting hairs on an Okian here, which is great. We could, you know, that's a subject all in itself. But on the story itself, I really am fascinated. I'm sitting here looking at Peter French's John Dee, The World of an Elizabethan Magus, and this came out about 72, I think, and French died then a few years later. And this book, there's a lot of material about what John Dee was studying, but not much about what he was doing, and also not much about his life. And is there any decent book on John Dee's, all of his life and his foreign travels and everything?
There's two very excellent books. I highly recommend The Queen's Conjurer by Benjamin Woolley, Woolley, and The Diaries of John Dee, which takes his, he had multiple diaries, and it collates them into a readable fashion where you can kind of get the arc of of his life. Through his own journals. So it'll take some from one journal and some from another. Like, you find out interesting things about him. For example, John Dee kept track of his wife's menstrual periods. He was always tying them in with what was happening astrologically. It's just interesting things about him as a person and kind of the way he saw the world and the way that he kind of reacted to things. There's been a lot of work on John Dee since that time, but I wanted to tell you a story about the Peter French book, is that when I read that originally, and I think around 1974, I was so moved by it, I sat down and started writing a novel about John Dee. So I actually wrote the first page of this novel in 1974, and it went through 10 drafts, 2 agents, about 10 editors, and I kept on taking it back and rewriting it and I mean completely from scratch multiple times, and this is the final project. I'm never going to rewrite it again.
It's been in development. That's what if this was a film, we would say it's been in development, and sometimes we call that development hell.
when you go back and rewrite it again and again and again, and then you get it, and then the producer looks at it and he says, well, I think you ought to do this, that, and the other thing, and oh boy. And I know what you mean. It was very difficult.
The big problem that I had originally, with the prior draft, I wrote a draft that actually got in the hands of a lot of editors, and I thought it was pretty good, but they all came back with the same thing. This is the previous draft. They said it needed something called a plot, and I thought that was very confusing at the time because I thought the plot was his life story, and I didn't understand that plot is very different. What I found I had done was write a fictionalized, not very good history. And so what I needed to do instead was to think about it as a book and put the history in the context of telling a story.
Oh, yeah, right.
That was the big leap forward.
Well, you really succeeded. They gave you, at least from the standpoint of a good read, of a really good page turner. Yeah, well, you did. You did exactly that, because I'm working on this, I'm putting the final touches on this thing that I'm doing, and we've been the same route. I started off, it's kind of historical, and I started off trying to keep it close to history, some producer read it on the way over to Cannes in the plane, and he said, "Oh, this is great, but I want it completely rewritten." So he said the same thing. He's got to have a plot. He's got to have a story. He's got to have an eternal triangle. He's got to have a, man against man, man against God, man against himself, the eternal triangle. All of that good stuff. And you did it.
I was so discouraged when I got that original review back from multiple editors. I didn't believe it, so I had to give. I gave it to another agent, which caused me to lose the agent I had, which was a good job. And then I gave it to, and then I paid an editor $1,000 to take a look at it and to tell me the same thing. So it was like it cost me a lot of time and effort to find out what I could have gotten if I just listened to the first guy that saw it. But
yeah, except it's worth it. Now, seriously, Jeff, it really is worth it because what you produced here is so professional. I went through it, and I just, and I know that, that you've been writing magic books and other things, I just looked at this, and I said, where in the hell did he learn to do a professional thing like this? And now you're telling us, you went the route.
Yeah.
You learned the hard way, and you sure did it.
Well, you know what's interesting? The way I was so discouraged when I got that draft back, and I got a play at the big time. I got a play at like some big editors looking at it, and they came back with that it was fundamentally flawed. It lacked a plot, and I didn't understand. I was so discouraged. I put it aside for about 4 years, and I got involved in a totally different kind of creative activity. I got involved in something called machinima, which is where you make a movie by programming computer games to move characters around and create raw footage, and then you mix it down with a video editor. And what I did was I ended up creating what is actually one of the most popular Star Trek fan films ever made. It's a feature-length movie called Borg War, and it's all done with computer animation. And working with that other medium was kind of like a painter working in sculpture for a while to get a better sense of form. Doing that kind of thing was pure plot, plot. And it broke away from me. I could break away from, you understand this as a writer, there's a tyranny to words. There's a tyranny to what you can express with them. And so in this case, I was, building these sets with a computer program and moving these, like, they're kind of like puppets around, like virtual puppets, and getting them to say things and speak and stuff. And that allowed me then to think about plot in a completely different way. And then I went back to writing the book and understood how to plot and how to handle multiple points of view because I worked in a completely different medium. And that silly Star Trek fan film has had 4 or 5 million downloads by now. And it was the first non-satire fan film ever to be shown at an actual Star Trek convention. Just sort of,
well,
it's just sort of interesting. It's sort of completely different than this, but
yeah.
It's also, it actually was part of the developmental process.
Yeah. Let's get back to the book here a little bit, because I know this is fascinating for me and for people that are interested in writing, but what we're mainly discussing here is the book and its background and its and you know, what it does, whatever, without spoilers. And I think your ending is absolutely has to be the way it has to be, and it's great, but I don't want to reveal it.
Okay.
You know, I really don't. And yet, the reason why I don't is so good. If the ending wasn't so beautifully handled and so appropriate, then we might talk about it, but because it is, I want the readers to appreciate it, and it's. But what I want to ask you a few things about this that the reader who has never heard of, well, a few of us, most everybody listening to this show knows about John Dee and Edward Shelley. They mostly do, but I don't think they actually understand what these people were, both of them were trying to do, and or what Dee was trying to do and Kelly was trying to help him do, and what you have in here is you're presenting Dee's alchemical background, which hardly anybody knows about at all, and yet Dee had everything Paracelsus ever produced, and he was really quite interested in alchemy, and you bring this up.
I was going to say that Dee saw, there was a key point in his life. It was about when he turned 50 where he kind of felt like he'd learned everything there was to learn.
Yeah. He'd
taken all, not really so much that, but really more that he had plumbed as much as he could get out of the literature and writings about alchemy and the writings about science and the writings about mathematics that had happened. He felt like he'd done all that, so he needed what he called what he called radical knowledge. He wanted to be able to extract knowledge. He thought the only way I'll be able to figure out the stuff that I want to figure out, like transmuting lead into gold and the elixir of life, is the only way I can get that is by extracting it directly from the mind of God. And so the reason why he practiced magic is because he believed that he could get a kind of like a communications going with higher entities and thereby learn secrets of science, which they didn't think of it as science at the time, but there were secrets about the world and what you could do with substances and even making machines that would fly through the air and devices to communicate at long distances. He had all the desires of a modern world, but he didn't have the technology to actually implement it, and so he thought he was going to get all those ideas from God.
Yeah, and after, because at the beginning of his reputation as a sorcerer was that flying scarab that he built for one of the theatrical productions, and it was so effective as a special effect, it was so effective that people thought that he'd really done it. I mean, that it actually flew without wires, but then, now there is, when they started doing the Enochian, or getting the Enochian material on the continent, and they spent about 6 years there wandering around to Poland and then down to Prague and various places. The way I understood it now was that when they started getting this material, they thought that they could sell it to Prince Lasky, who you pictured Lasky as a down at the heels nobleman who was pretending to be a lot richer than he was. But I understood it that they wanted to sell this terrestrial victory, which is, eventually became the Aether system. They wanted to sell this terrestrial victory system to the Polish government to control politics. I think you have something in there about perhaps they wanted to do that to produce gold or something or other. Now, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, the two are really the reason why he was taken seriously, and the majority of, he had a number of patrons. Originally, mm-hmm. Queen Elizabeth was his patron, and then later in his life, she was a distant patron, not as close as she had been. And in between, he left Elizabeth for Count Lasky, who left England with a bunch of debts and really didn't turn out very well. And then he tried to get the Holy Roman Emperor interested in the work he was doing and failed to do that. And then he eventually, one of the emperor's most powerful noblemen, a man named Rosenberg, who probably incidentally is the model for Christian Rosencrantz in the Rosicrucian, that he actually did become a patron and set them up in a small castle and said, here's all the money you need to do what you want to do. And that's really when things started moving for them, and the ceremonies and the results they were getting started getting progressively stranger and more distant from the cultural background and the Christianity that originally Dee had espoused, and started getting actually to look a lot more like paganism and some of the other ways of looking at the world.
Now, that's what Peter Fritz says. He says that Dee was a nominal Christian and more of a hermetic classical pagan. I would certainly agree with that. On the business of the terrestrial victory. Now, originally terrestrial victory and all these different ethers were supposedly different sections. They were applied to a map of the world, the known world at that time, and all these governors supposedly controlled different countries. Somehow or other, that system never did get off the ground, or at least when they got it firmed up. It's not part of your book, but when do you think that terrestrial victory stopped being some sort of an angelic matrix to control international politics and became an ascension of the aethers, pretty much like Valentine Gnosticism? When do you think that happened?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that they were driving towards a point, and they were the patronage was always dependent upon the fact that people believed that they'd be able to do amazing things, specifically creating the first substance, specifically creating the substance that can transform metal, and specifically creating the substance that can create the elixir of life. That was the driving force of where they needed to go and where he hoped to go. But meanwhile, the angels that they were talking to, or the conversations, started getting less and less about the real world and more, or about, you know, physical things and politics and stuff like that, and became more and more kind of apocalyptic and talking about how the world would end and how everything would wrap up, and then it started becoming not just apocalyptic but also very sexual. There were lots of imagery, unexpected sexual imagery that started getting into the ceremonies too, or into the results, or what Kelly was seeing. So it was a gradual process that developed. What you're talking about, a gradual process that developed over about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, you know, there is a lot of Book of Revelations. I mean, as we know, there's the Book of Revelations is almost a template for the Call of the 30 Aethers, you get. The apocalyptic aspect of it all the way through, but the sexual thing, they ended up wife swapping, or what they call the covenant. And the way you handled that, I thought was very, very mature and realistic handling of that whole situation. You're not really sure whether Kelly has ginned this up consciously, or whether he is doing what he wants to do subconsciously and then denying it, which in a sense, from a con man point of view, that gives it more credibility. You know, a con man doesn't want to talk you into something; he wants to talk you out of what he wants you to do. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a standard con trick.
is to present this thing to you and then say, oh, but God, we can't do this, you know.
Yeah.
There's
also another standard con trick, which is that when you're running the con, you believe in the con.
Yeah.
There's actually a scene, I don't know if you remember the old movie, The Music Man. It's about a con man who's actually the hero of the movie. And at one point, one of his victims confronts him with the fact that this isn't real. You're just conning us. And he says, yeah, but I believe it when I'm talking about it. That's essentially what he says. And you'll find that the best people are able, who do things like that, are able to convince themselves that it's real while they're talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
They actually don't realize it's unreal. And so I'm not sure he knew whether it was something that was coming out of himself or something that was coming from somewhere else. I think he just, was kind of, he really didn't know himself, probably.
Yeah, you're right, he didn't, but it was still a mendacious, kind of a mendacious thing, and I don't think he ever would have considered it if it hadn't been in some kind of supernatural context like that.
Absolutely not. I agree with you.
Yeah, no, he wouldn't have.
Actually funny in the diaries, there's this line in the diaries, in Dee's diaries, that I think is just so telling. And it's when he's introducing this idea that they share their wives in common to his wife. And he has a conversation with his wife, and she says, well, all right, as long as I'm not inconvenienced.
Yeah.
That was her actual line, which I think it really tells a wonder about what their relationship was like.
Well, it gave you a good clue to how to characterize her, too, and you characterized her very, very well. I thought the two female characters were beautifully drawn and are just pretty much what they would have been. And the dynamic, you know, the dynamic between the characters works out very, very well. And
I appreciate that. You know, that means a lot coming from a writer like yourself. It really does, because I know that you understand that there's a lot of craft involved in making that happen.
Oh, yeah, I sure do. At least I understand that, although I think that, frankly, to tell you the truth, I think this novel is a better effort than some of my novels have been.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Yeah, I really do. But I also can see now, especially after talking with you, how much work you put into it. And that, you know, that really shows in the way that it flowed. Now, a couple of other things. Without getting too much of a teaser, now, it is true that me actually spent some time with the King of Poland, who was a Bathory. And, of course, the Bathory family, as we all know, are very much, Elizabeth Bathory was the great vampire lady of Hungary.
Yeah,
and
she's actually, she's distantly related to Vlad the Impaler, too, by the way.
Yeah.
It was fun developing that concept. Mm-hmm. There's actually no record that John Dee met Elizabeth Bathory. Well, she would have been 17 about the time he was around.
I could not resist putting her in the novel. This is the kind of thing that you just cannot. You can't let this not be done, because even if he hadn't actually met her, when she was 17, she's probably already into this. Or even if she wasn't.
I'm sure she was very strange when she was 17.
She probably was very strange at 17. She's probably strange at 12. But this is one of these things you just can't pass up. As a historical novelist, you can't pass it up. It's just like this thing I'm doing on the Russian Civil War. I just had to have Rasputin in it. I just had to, even though according to my time frame, he had already been murdered, according to the time frame of the story, but I just had to have him. I couldn't do it without Rasputin, you know. I mean, you just have to. So you had to have Elizabeth Bathory in there. And Rudolf. Now, it was Rudolf, the emperor. Was he the one that used to collect the mummified fingers and had them in his pocket, or is that a later Rudolf?
No, that was his uncle. Philip II of Spain, who had been married to Queen Elizabeth's sister. And he was a great, that's actually entirely 100% true. He surrounded himself when he slept with reliquaries filled with pieces of dead saints. He slept right in the middle of it. He was a very, very strange man. He celebrated one of his marriages by having an auto da fe and basically blowing up a bunch of heretics. Blowing them up. He thought that would be a fun thing to do on his wedding night. The guy was very, very odd.
And you're a villain. Now let's. Your villain is a bit like. It's a bit like one of Dan Brown's villains, but you do a better job. In other words, this is a Catholic, a devout Catholic assassin. And your assassin, your devout Catholic assassin, is more Catholic and more devout than Dan Brown's. And that makes it all the more frightening.
Yeah, the villains are always, as you know, villains are always fun to write.
I
got a lot of joy out of writing that character, and he grows, and just as all the other characters do, they change and grow during the process of the novel. He changes and grows too, and changes into a different person and starts thinking about power and how he can kill more people more effectively. And he has his own arc of what he wants to accomplish, and that includes getting rid of John Dee.
And of course, the way you handled it. It is so true that people commit these, and we can say they're mentally ill, and of course perhaps they are, I would suppose say, but they can completely rationalize what those horrendous acts that they're doing, completely rationalize it and think that they are actually gaining favor in the eyes of God by doing this sort of thing.
That makes for a very scary character when they're convinced that God is on their side no matter what they do.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And I think, as I said, I think you outdid Dan Brown and his. He had one of these Opus Dei characters that was doing somewhat similar. But your Catholic assassin is a villain. Boy, that's a villain that you could write a whole book about, just that villain. Did you ever hear of back to Dee's background, a book called The Book of Soiga? Does that ring a bell with you as a manuscript?
Yeah. The Book of Soiga was one of the earlier books that were promised in the early phases of Dee's work, and a great deal was made of it by one of his first biographers, and so it became considered something very important. But actually, it's something that, if I recall, is just sort of mentioned in passing, and never really gone all that into effect. I think it might have been with one of the sessions that he had before Edward Kelly. I can't remember exactly when it was placed. But it in no way is as important as the Enochian material or the material that I covered in the book Enochian Evocation, which was actually the three magical systems that Dee developed with Edward Kelly.
Yeah, that book, by the way, I'll mention that too, because that's still in print, I believe, it's still available.
Sure.
As you recall, I knew you back when you were writing that. And I think I did help you a little bit getting some manuscripts out of the British Museum for that one.
I did.
But that book has more depth because your Latin was very good, and you were able to get in there and translate these Latin, which most of these people couldn't do. And so you have a lot more Enochian information, these prayers, and his actual operations than anybody else has come up with in quite a while, as far as I know.
Well, I appreciate that. What I would try to do with that particular book was to sort of look at the wealth of Dee's material, much of which is contained in his diaries, and organize it in the form of a grimoire. So it really, in the form of, here are three specific systems of magic that Dee developed with Edward Kelly through what they called conversations with angels. And you have to, like, slog through, if you read the diaries, you have to slog through pages and pages and pages and pages to see what they're getting at. And what I did is collected all the relevant parts and put them in one book so you could kind of, here's his magical system. There was the heptarchal system, which was planetary. There was the four quadrants, which was elemental, earth, air, fire, and water. And there was the Enochian system, which was actually based on the 12 tribes, which is zodiacal. So he had zodiacal, he has elements covered, and he has planets covered. So it was intended, as Dee saw it, as a complete system of magic that encompasses, you know, all three of those ways of magical practice.
And, of course, as we know, Dee and Kelly both were steeped in Agrippa, and what they came up with was very structured. The structure was very hermetic and Kabbalistic, but their alphabet was not as long as the Hebrew alphabet. They had 19 letters, and their grids, their Kamehameha-style grids, didn't quite match up with, although I know Mathers made a heroic effort to do that, to match them up with the regular hermetic system. Have you found anywhere in any of the attempts, including Hulse and the first guy to attempt was Rudd, 150 years after Dee, Dr. Rudd tried to, and then more recently Crowley tried, I don't know, these Harlem Solace, which is a Golden Dawn knockoff, they came up with their own version of terrestrial victory. But has anybody that you know of really gotten a figured out, to your satisfaction, all of those little numeric insertions in the various Enochian calls? Has anybody got a handle on that yet?
Actually, there's been a lot of very interesting work done with computer analysis of some of the tables and looking at the patterns of letters in them, entering them in. And it turns out that those 49 by 49 square, they're these 49 by 49 boxes with 49, that many boxes in it, whatever 49 times 49 is. And there's little letters in almost all the boxes. And it's really crazy. There's pages and pages and pages of this stuff, and it's only recently that they've been able to understand that it's actually quite complex on its own, and there's actually sort of a logic to the way that it's all absorbed. But you literally have to stick it through a computer and do pattern analysis in order to understand what's there, which is very strange if you think about it, because it's all in a person's handwriting, and it certainly wasn't created with a computer. It's just interesting that there actually is a lot of research being done now on kind of where that all came from and what it all might mean.
Well, I do know, and I think most of us do realize that Enochian is a system that seems to have been 400 years ahead of its time, as far as because it is a system that really lends itself to computer, to computer operation. In fact, it is in its own way a kind of a computer to access the dark side of the mind, and kind of functions in that way. And it's just why it's such a powerful system of magic. One last question I want to ask you. Do you think, I know what we've done, we've taken the archangels, the four archangels of the quadrants, the standard hermetic quadrants, and we have inserted them into the watchtower opening for each of the tablets. In other words, we put the air tablet under Raphael, and we put that right in the invocation in the watchtower opening. We put the fire tablet under Michael, and water tablet under Gabriel, and the earth tablet under Uriel. And we have those right in there in the invocation. Do you think perhaps if Dee and Kelly had done that, maybe they might not have had some of the trouble that they had?
I don't know, but I will tell you this much. You and John Dee would have gotten along really well. because you think
probably
you think like he does.
I think you and he
would sit down and you would just say they'd be like you knew each other your whole life.
I think that Nee would probably, after everything had happened, and I would suggest that Nee would probably say, "Well, you know, we probably should have done that. I didn't think of it at the time, but we probably should have, because perhaps the great archangels would not quite have approved of some of the things that." Yeah, I think that's a good thing to do with a Nokia, and I really do. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, and everybody. The book is on Amazon right now, and I got a review on there. I think that's the first review. The book's on there on Amazon. I heartily recommend it. Whether you want to be an Enochian magician or not, you don't have to be an Enochian magician to enjoy this book. This book is great. So thank you so much for coming on board. Now, next week we have Franz Barden, so everybody tune in on that one. And then the following week we'll have another show. And what did we say we were going to do? We're going to have call-ins. Next week, 2 weeks, we're going to have call-ins. And you can call in and talk about all of these topics, whatever. And, Jeff, if you want to call in 2 weeks, and we'll chat, we can chat some more. Maybe somebody will ask you some questions. Okay, anyway, take care, be well, and good magic.